Nothing is more important than getting a good night's sleep, and when you don't get the rest you need, your whole day is thrown off. That's why it's so important to choose the right mattress. Sleeping on a Purple mattress is truly a unique experience, because Purple mattresses are made with a GelFlex grid. The GelFlex grid is an innovative material that moves with your body to relieve pressure in areas like knees and hips, and support in others, like your back. It feels soft where you want it and supports where you need it. Purple mattresses instantly adapt when you move. You don't sink in and get stuck like with memory foam. And thanks to over 1,400 air chambers in the GelFlex grid, you will sleep cooler on a Purple mattress. Purple has a wide variety of mattresses, from the original Purple mattress to the Restore Hybrid Collection that combines GelFlex grid with coils, and the Rejuvenate Luxe Collection, the height of luxury, with over 112,000 five-star reviews to prove it. Visit purple.com to find the perfect Purple for you and enter code PODCAST10 to get 10% off. It's better over
here. AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free, all on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Pay off up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port-in trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. MIDI clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. MIDI offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
This time on Vet Story.
It's an inside perspective on the daily life of Marines in Afghanistan. Because I just got sick of seeing the same inaccurate portrayals, you know? You truly get, almost uncomfortably close to these guys, because I was one of them. But there's a scene towards the end where Jacob even gets shot.
Hey, I'm hit!
And I start firing at these two guys on a hill. You have like the super gym rat guys that were ordering steroids and stuff. The guys there, you know, we were smoking pot a lot. Reaches into his pocket and pulls out a piece of hash the size of a baseball.
What kind of hurdles did you have to clear to get this B-roll put together?
You kind of have to externalize death. The humorous way that you have to treat death almost, you know, just to get by. So I'm proud. I'm happy that I made it out alive. But I have a lot of replicant feelings about why I wanted to go in the first place. I don't think there was a mission. I'm not sure what the mission was. Even the generals have no fucking answer to that. And then I realized the only way that they can understand is by just showing it, closing the military-civilian gap, you know?
Welcome to Vet Story. I'm your host, Navy veteran Phil Briggs. Now, over the last couple years, I've interviewed everyone, from authors to actors to TV show writers, but very few have brought a project that's as provocative, as controversial, as the one you're about to hear. Miles Lugosi is a Marine Corps veteran and a filmmaker. His recent war documentary is called Combat Obscura. Jessica Duffield at Vox Magazine writes, "The beauty of the film is its realness." All the footage is taken directly from his camera. The camera, incidentally, was the one issued to him by the Marine Corps. As a member of the division, known as combat camera. And just like Miles' film, our phone conversation is raw and real. We'll talk about the uncomfortable conversations he had to have with officials in the Marine Corps and the Department of Defense just to be able to release the film. And he shares with me some stories behind the making of Combat Obscura. All right, welcome to Vet Story, Miles.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. I mean, I couldn't look away from Facebook the other day when you guys dropped your trailer. I mean, I must have watched it like 3 or 4 times. I think I was on a plane recently and I was sitting next to the person and they're like, "What's war like?" You know, as the typical person asks a veteran, right? And I got my Navy shirt on. And of course, I'm sitting there going, well, here, look at this YouTube clip. I pulled the trailer up for Combat Obscura and I was like, this is kind of what it looks like. So I appreciate what you put out. Before we get to the documentary and all the friction that's being caused by it, or you know, some of the fallout around it, talk to me a little bit about your background. You were combat cam, right?
Yeah, so I enlisted out of high school. I saw Full Metal Jacket. It was obsessed with Full Metal Jacket, and I saw, you know, the main character was a combat correspondent, and I was like, wow, I can just join the military and not have to go to college, not have to go to journalism school, and just be out there filming the war.
I wanted to see exotic Vietnam, the jewel of Southeast Asia. I wanted to meet interesting and stimulating people of an ancient culture and kill them. I wanted to be the first kid on my block to get a confirmed kill.
And to me, that seemed really, you know, I had a glamorized kind of idea of it, I think. But to me, it seemed like the most important thing to be doing at 18.
No, I'm a combat correspondent.
Oh, you seen much combat?
Well, I've seen a little on TV.
And in fact, Private Joker really did give it kind of a gloss. It wasn't always that glamorous. But I want you to know that when I was in the Navy, I was generation before you. I was in the 90s. And my dream billet, if it were open, was to go to combat cam out of Little Creek. Because they were such hard chargers. Everyone I'd ever like hung out with from the ComCam teams, you know, had ribbons and shit that we didn't get in the fleet. And I was like, man, I want to do that. How'd you do that? And was it tough to get into combat camera? Because there aren't a whole lot of billets opening.
Not at all. I mean, I did the ASVAB test. My recruiter was like, you could basically choose anything. I was like, how about combat camera? And he was like, what the fuck is combat camera? Really, I knew more about him than he did. You know, he looked it up and he got me the paperwork. Yeah, it was pretty easy.
As a Marine, then you go through Marine Corps boot camp and stand there on the golden footprints, right? And your birthplace, you become a devil dog. You become a Marine. Did you then go to MC school, trained as like a DINFOS trained killer?
I mean, yeah, you go to MC. You do combat training after boot camp. And then, then you go to DINFOS, and they basically give you a crash course on whatever you are. Back when I was in, they separated like combat correspondents and photographers and videographers. All that was separate. And now it's all merged into one. But back then it was separate. And so you get like a crash course if you're video. They teach you how to edit and stuff. And put you in the woods and shoot paintballs at you. You got to film it. It's sort of, you don't really come out like knowing that much about video. You kind of pick it up on the job, you know, depending on if you have good NCOs and stuff that know what they're doing. But yeah, then they send you out.
So straight out of school, as we all were, you know, when I finished my training at DINFOS, you know, you get to the fleet and you're like, look at me, I got all these ideas. How does shit really work? When you got there, are you well received when you say I'm your comm cam guy, or are most dudes like, what are you here for, bro? What is your deal?
Yeah, it's both. Like, I mean, it depends on the unit. Like 1-6 had combat camera guys with them in Marja and stuff. So they were into it. I mean, they liked, you know, my nickname was YouTube and the other photo guy was named Facebook. You know, they wanted to be Facebook famous and stuff. and get their images, get their, you know, photos out there and stuff. But yeah, you get your share of, like, I had a lieutenant who was like, are you actually getting deployed with us? I was like, yeah, I mean, my job, you know? But yeah, it's mixed. You get some guys that just think you're going to get them in trouble, you know, taking pictures without their proper gear. Like, that was the big thing. Like, oh, first sergeant's going to chew my ass because he released a photograph of me without my gloves on or something, you know, or my iPro on. And then you have the guys that are just like, dude, you have to come out with us in this operation. Like, with, you know, they'll like get rid of, you know, one asset to take in combat camera, you know, just so that we're there documenting.
And in the spirit of all things military, I mean, you earn your place in the tribe. I mean, they bust your balls enough times, you bust right back. They, you know, you show you can carry the gear or you can help and be some sort of assistance. You earn your stripes. You get to be part of the club. So did you find that kind of took place too? Like, once you settled in for a couple days, couple weeks, like?
Yeah, I mean, once you start standing, like, mostly they just want you to stand post occasionally because they fucking hate, everyone hates standing post. I was going on two patrols a day with each squad, you know, I was trying to film as much as I could, but then I'd come back and stand post and stuff like that kind of shows that you're not just there to, do your job, but you can also help them out if they need it.
Cool. Last question before we get into the movie. When you're on patrol and you're lugging the gear, right? So you got your camera and some battery packs, and you probably don't need lighting, but I mean, you're lugging camera gear around. Do you also have to carry a rifle? Because what happens in the situation when shit goes down? Like, you have to put down your camera and pick up a gun and be a Marine.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, everyone has a rifle. Like, you don't leave the wire without a rifle. But, yeah, there's actually a scene in the film, but not to get into it just yet, but there's a scene towards the end when Jacob Levy gets shot. And in that moment, I was just like, I saw two guys on a hill. You see the camera drop to the ground, and I start firing at these two guys on a hill who were just like, in hindsight, were just sitting there, I think, watching us. But in that heightened moment, I thought they were armed. Thankfully, I didn't hit them. But yeah, that was the one time I actually fired my rifle.
Right on, man. Well, I know that you brought so much together in this film and gave us a glimpse that few war films really do, because most of the time war films are done, you know, with actors, and it's Hollywood magic. Even if it's on location, there's still a lot of, you know, cut, take two, you know, a lot of chances to get it right and to make it look perfect. This is raw and this is gritty and this is highly imperfect. This is the way it really kind of looked through your lens. Talk to me about first what inspired you to make the movie.
Yeah, I mean, first, just having these memories that I was trying to deal with on my laptop, you know, and then second, like, after, like, coming to terms with it, trying to make something as honest as possible, you know, and something that, not just honest, but something new that I hadn't really seen before, even in other war documentaries like Restrepo and stuff. Yeah, that was kind of like the main impulse to do it, to just kind of, because I just got sick of seeing the same inaccurate portrayals, you know. And I was enrolled in film school at the time, so, you know, it felt like something I should do.
Right on.
I mean, it was a year, I worked on it for years, you know, it was sort of an obsession.
Yeah. And it gives people a glimpse, like if you were to tell somebody to describe Combat Obscura to somebody that just said, hey, tell me about your movie, Miles. you know, a civilian, no military background at all. How do you describe what you put together for someone?
Well, I guess like the tagline is, you know, the film that the Marine Corps doesn't want you to see. But it's, you know, it's not, that's sort of an exaggeration on some levels, but it's also, it is, you know, it's an inside perspective of the daily life of Marines in Afghanistan. It's not from a civilian. It's not from, you know, a journalist or a filmmaker, a reporter. It's just like one of the guys. It's like the footage you see on YouTube occasionally that soldiers post themselves and stuff. It's like a compilation of that. And you truly get, almost uncomfortably close to these guys because I was one of them. And I think it's really important to have that honesty and that perspective, you know, as we move forward and just closing the military civilian gap, you know, cause it's like you said, the military is such a mystery to most civilians, you know, the wars.
Yeah, man. And I'm super glad you did it. I have to ask, as a guy that was in the military myself, how in the hell did you end up with this footage on a laptop? And if I can ask, was it legal? I mean, like, did you have to, what kind of hurdles did you have to clear to get this B-roll put together? Because, I mean, that's the Marine Corps shit, isn't it?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, it's a super gray area. As far as, like, quote unquote, taking the footage, I mean, everybody has cameras out there. You know, we include a lot of helmet cam or GoPro footage from the grunts that were with 1-6. And so, like, no one, and you know, like, the military is totally, it's a disorganization. It's not, it's totally mismanaged and bureaucratic, and no one's really, you know, looking at who's got cameras and who's filming, you know, like, going through our footage and stuff. I mean, you know what, they were mainly looking, like, when we left from Afghanistan, what they were mainly looking for was guys bringing, like, weapons. You know, AK-47s, drugs. One guy tried to bring a grenade on the plane that he found in a weapons cache. Not a smart move, obviously.
Right.
So that's the kind of stuff that they're looking for when you actually peace out, you know, from any country.
Okay.
But as far as the legal stuff, it's complicated. I am working with some great, you know, First Amendment institutions, and you know, we're lucky that the Marine Corps is not pursuing legal action at this time, and we're pretty confident that, you know, we're very confident to release the film and that it is legal.
Cool. Have you had anybody from the Marine Corps review it and get back to you with their thoughts? Because, I mean, I know in the public affairs world, you know, obviously everything we did was edited and they got sent up to a, you know, command sergeant major or, a public affairs officer, 03 or above, and then they signed off on it. You were out of the military when you made this, but did you get a blessing? Did you get any indication that the Marine Corps had seen this and been like, well, that's pretty legit?
Well, I wouldn't call it blessing. I mean, I submitted it through the Pentagon because I didn't want to have to deal with the Marine Corps. And they have this office that basically just reviews ex-CIA guys' manuscripts and guys that are writing books. And they look for classified information. And they cleared it. You know, there's obviously nothing classified in it. It's just regular ground pounders. There's no special forces that I was filming or, like, combat operations center and stuff like that. I wasn't filming that stuff, so they cleared it, but in that process, they also sent it to the Marine Corps. And I met with Lieutenant Colonel with the Media Entertainment Liaison Office. And he was actually pretty chill. Like, he wasn't against the film. He just kind of wanted to understand it and, like, where I was coming from. He was fine with it, like, being shown. It wasn't like they came down on me like, you know, the hammer up Thor. It was a back and forth, you know, and it was sort of, on some level, I think that he got it, that one Lieutenant Colonel, he understood it, that I was trying to make an honest portrayal. But I think the, like, other brass in their statements that have come out are pretty against it, you know, and they want to look at it like, these are just some bad apples, you know, this isn't reflective of the military as a whole, or blah, 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 you know, the typical spiel.
Yeah. To that, let's talk a little bit specific real quick about the film. What were some parts of it you think that maybe the bigger brass had some problems with. And I'll just throw it out there. The smoking the hash through the Pringles can.
Mm-hmm.
How in the hell did you even come upon that? And tell me the story with that scene and what the DOD said about it.
Well, that scene was pretty typical of a night spent at this one patrol base that I was at a lot. The guys there, you know, we were smoking pot a lot. It was everywhere. We were getting it from the locals, the weed fields, there was opium. And, some of them were like, you had like the super gym rat guys that were ordering steroids and stuff from Japan and places like that. But then you had the stoners. It was kind of, you know, the military is like high school, you know, you have your cliques and stuff.
Right, right.
And I kind of drifted and I tried to film both. Like you see the, you know, roided out dudes working out at night and stuff. And you see them smoking weed, and you see some guys playing chess. It's like, it's you know, a very diverse group. But, that was like a typical night smoking. I think that was opium.
And that wasn't that uncommon, though. Like, that wasn't just a fluke, like the one time you found it, and they were like, what should we do with it, Sarge? I don't know. Let's smoke it.
It happened a lot. I mean, I remember patrolling through, it was Ramadan, and it was patrolling through a field. And everybody, you know, they were all inside praying and stuff. And there was one farmer outside in this field alone. And we walked past him, we were talking to him. And he literally reaches into his pocket and pulls out a piece of hash the size of a baseball and just gave it to us. I don't know why. I don't know why we didn't ask him for it. He just gave it to us. But, yeah, that lasted like the whole deployment almost, you know?
I can imagine. The size of a freaking baseball, dude, that must have been like 50 grams or something. That's crazy.
Yeah, it was nuts. So that kind of stuff happened all the time. Mm-hmm. And not everybody, like I said, not everybody smoked. It's not supposed to, I'm not trying to universalize these guys or the experience in any way, but it was definitely very common.
Okay.
You got to understand also, like a lot of these guys were 21, 22, and they had multiple pumps before. So they were done with the Marine Corps. They were getting out as soon as we got home, and they were bored. And you know, it was just a thing to do, I guess.
Yeah, man. And again, an unvarnished look at life on the ground for a grunt. And you know, you told it like it was. So I can respect it and appreciate it. What were some of the harder things to edit together? You said that part of assembling this movie was kind of cathartic for you. It was a way to kind of, I don't know, deal with your demons. What were some of the things that were hard to put together and edit?
Obviously, you know, the scene with Levy getting shot, I had felt guilty just for shooting that. You know, I had mixed feelings about including that. I had to speak to his mom. You know, I met with her. She had already, like, seen the footage a long time ago, because the guy, I had given it to the guys after it initially happened, like when we got home. And so she had seen it, but she hadn't seen the whole film. We watched it, and you know, she gave it her blessing. Other things like killing a chicken, you know, like a lot of, you'd be surprised how many people are most upset by the chicken scene. And not the dead Afghan, not, you know, Levy, but like these guys killing a chicken. That was hard to include. But it ultimately came down to assembling it into a way that was going to challenge people's feelings about the military, but also about death, you know, because that scene is included right before the dead shopkeeper. And I wanted to show how you kind of have to externalize death, you know, when you're out there, and the sort of humorous nature of the humorous way that you have to treat death almost, you know, just to get by.
Yeah. And you yourself, did the movie help you come to terms with what you had witnessed and what you saw on that deployment?
I was going kind of crazy working on it for so long. You know, I split up with my wife because of it, sort of. Just finishing it. And coming to like an honest interpretation, because when I first started working on it, I wasn't being honest. And I was trying too hard to explain things as if I was reaching a civilian audience that wasn't going to understand. And then I realized the only way that they can understand is by just showing it, you know, and they'll get the picture, they'll get it themselves, and they'll be able to do it internally instead of having some veteran explain it to them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like don't tell people what to take away from it. Let each and every person take away what they want from it, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense, man. Ultimately, with this movie, are you trying to glorify life in the Marine Corps?
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think a lot of vets are conflicted about it, you know, because it's such a transformative period of your life, you know? And it does define who you are, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm proud. I'm proud that I made it out alive. But I have a lot of conflicted feelings about why I wanted to go in the first place and why we were ultimately there and what effect we had and if it was positive or negative in the ultimate outcome, you know.
Yeah, and I guess that speaks to a question that I wasn't ready to ask, but I might as well since we're here. Having been there, do you feel that the world's a better place? Do you feel that Afghanistan's a better place? Do you think that we achieved the mission?
I don't think there was a mission. I'm not sure what the mission was. I don't see how they thought what we were doing was going to just magically work. And then what was the end goal? Like, what would happen if we defeated the Taliban? Would we set up a government in Helmand Province where people don't even identify as Afghans? And they're like, how do we... We're very good at going in and, you know, bringing, you know, death and destruction on a certain level. You know, we're good at fighting.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what we're good at. But in a place like Afghanistan, that can't be the only thing that you're doing. Like, there has to be an end goal. There has to be some kind of next step, even if we were to wipe out the Taliban. And that never really, even the generals have no fucking answer to that. I've never heard a decent answer, like, what was going to be the outcome or what was the desired outcome and what would happen after we left. Were we just going to stay there forever? Which we have at this point. We've been there. So, you know, we're still there. It's 18 years going on, 19.
Yeah. Yeah, if I could magically appoint you or put some extra stars on your collar or make you just in charge.
Oh, God.
What do
Don't
you...
Do that.
Yeah, right. Let's let the filmmaker tell us what we should do. No, but really, what's an after-action strategy look like? In your humble opinion, having been there, is there something that we could do that we don't do that would help the people in these areas that have been taken over by terrorism that we've tried to liberate?
Well, I mean, okay, just focusing on Afghanistan, because each country is different.
Sure.
But just Afghanistan, we created the Taliban, you know, back in the 80s when Russia invaded. We were funding the Mujahideen to fight against, you know, against the Soviets. They in turn then became the Taliban. So we're responsible for their rise, right? I think we should have looked into more just talking with them at first. If they're just going in and bombing, and, you know, they were housing Al-Qaeda, but they weren't like... I don't see the Taliban as the same as ISIS or Al-Qaeda. You know, I see them as a local Afghan and Pakistani militia that wants to have their version of Sharia law and stuff enforced on the locals. So they are oppressive, but they're not so extreme that they can't, that they're not open to talking, which is exactly what we're doing now after 18 years of, you know, senseless violence. That the Afghan army has lost more soldiers in the past 2 years than we did the entire time we were there. They're just getting massacred. And the Taliban has taken over almost every region that we were in like Helmand Province especially. So we're finally talking with them, and we're going to the table. I think that could have been done from the beginning. Because they don't... You have to look at... You can't just say, okay, let's fucking kill them all. So let's get rid of them. You have to look at, okay, well, then what? And who's going to take the place once they're gone? And can we talk to them? Are they open to negotiating? Which they are. I mean, I don't trust the Taliban as much as the next guy, but they are open to certain shifts in their policy and their interpretation of Islam and everything. At least they've expressed that.
Wow.
Complicated, man. I don't want that responsibility. You know, I don't want to have to say what we should or shouldn't do. I just think that we should be looking at the big picture more in the future and not just the immediate, like, you know, intervention military strategy.
No, and it's geopolitical chess, and I feel you on that. I mean, like, you can't just look at the move that you have to make. You have to think about what's going to happen three moves ahead, because you are going to play this game for quite a long time. I've just always wondered. No one's ever told me when I've asked that question, make it look like America. And I always wondered, like, okay, how come in our wake we don't just leave behind seven strip malls, a Home Depot, and a Walmart? Like, isn't that what the people there crave? And at no point from talking to any warfighter have I ever heard that that's what the people wanted. We didn't set a town up for them. Right on.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Well, Miles, great talking to you about this. The movie is Combat Obscura, and where can I see it? Where can everybody catch this?
I think it's still in a few theaters in certain places, and it'll be for a while, but it's also on iTunes and Amazon and Google Play and Vudu and all that good stuff.
So just download it wherever I download movies and TV shows and podcasts and stuff like that, right?
Yep.
All right, Combat Obscura, and I know you raised a lot of eyebrows, some blood pressure got raised, and I just hope you keep making movies, man, because you got a gift, and I really appreciate you sharing.
All right, thanks a lot, man. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to four lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
In the fast-paced world of attacking, speed is everything. And that's where the Furon 7 Plus shines. Engineered for accuracy and precision at a rapid pace, it's your secret weapon on the pitch. Experience overall comfort and precise striking, even in the game's fastest moments. The nylon outsole, with its V-shaped stud configuration, is designed for firm ground, giving you the grip you need to outmaneuver your opponents. Step up your attacking game and learn more and purchase the Furon at NewBalance.com.
Struggling with mental health shouldn't be the norm. At Mindful Therapy Group, we specialize in connecting you with compassionate therapists to find the perfect fit for you. Mindful Therapy Group accepts most health insurances. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com to start your mental health journey today.
Now, with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Day, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.